Great. Just sitting down with Richard this afternoon. Thanks so much for being here and agreeing to share your story with me. I'm looking forward to hearing it. Just to get started, could you tell me a little bit about how you first started connecting to the gay community or engaging in gay life?
I guess probably when I was about 18, or yeah, about 18 years old in Calgary, when I was still living at home in Calgary. And I think, like most young gay guys, I was just, started off in parks and meeting guys in parks and playing around, and then I met my first partner in, God, when would that be? I guess it would be 85. No, it was before that, because it was before we moved out here. So it would be about 83, I guess. Yeah, is when I met Ron. And he was my first love and slash long-term partner. But he passed away from AIDS in 93, as did most of my good friends, or they died between about 88 and 93, 94, 95, 96, up until the new meds came out in 96. And what's the next question?
I was just going to poke a little more about what was gay life like in Calgary at the time. Was there like a lot of formalized gay institutions, like bars and
Yeah,
stuff
there was
there?
lots of bars and lots of bathhouses and lots of sex going on, and it was just the way it was. It was a different world. It was a very different world back then, prior to AIDS and HIV, and much freer, much like to just, all the bars had back rooms, and it was just the way it was. Every bar had a back room, and yeah, it was just the way it was.
And then when did you move out to Vancouver?
I moved to here in 84, because I was applying to UBC and UVic, and I got accepted at both and basically had my choice of where I wanted to go to school, and I chose Vancouver. That's what brought me out here. And I came out here with my partner. And yeah, I lived a pretty wonderful life for the first few years. And then I remember about, I guess about 86, we started reading in the newspapers about the Kaposi's sarcoma and the rare gay cancer, and it was, but at that point it was still pretty much localized to LA and San Francisco and New York, and hadn't really been affected by it here in Vancouver at that point. But I just remember it wasn't very long before it started to, before Vancouver did start to be affected by it. And then we started seeing more and more signs of people getting sick, and started seeing people on the streets here covered in Kaposi's sarcoma lesions, and just the wasting disease back then. And it was starting to get scary. It was starting to get really scary about 88, 89. And then, like I said, the majority, I'd say 8 out of 10 friends died before 96. Everybody died. That's what we used to joke about, was it was the trendy thing to do was to die. And I know it sounds kind of morbid now to say that, but it was just, if you didn't laugh about it, you cried, because it was just so awful. But yeah, I remember my first friend I lost, Fernando. I lost him, and I guess Fernando was gone by about 88. And then there was George and Brent and Gordon, and then my partner Ron, and it was just everybody I knew pretty much. And I'm not sure what else to say.
How was the community here in Vancouver responding at the
Oh
time?
well, it was wonderful. That's the one time in my life that I've or not the one time in my life, I shouldn't say that, but that's one of the times in my life that I was very proud of my community, because nobody else wanted to even touch us. Like, I remember paramedics refusing to even touch us if they found out we were HIV positive. And it was just, it was dreadful. And that's when my community, including my gay sisters, really came together, and we built BCPWA and AIDS Vancouver, and went on to build the Dr. Peter Center and Friends for Life, and we did that all on our own, because nobody else was helping us back then. In fact, nobody even wanted anything to do with us, let alone even acknowledge the fact that there was this disease that was devastating, just decimating our community. But so we rose to the occasion, you know? Yeah, it was pretty, it's one of the one of the times of my life that I've been the most proud of my community, was how we responded to that terrible, terrible time.
Did you get involved with any of those organizations?
Oh yeah, I was, I didn't take my long-term disability until 93, because I had just graduated from UBC in 1990, and so I had put off getting tested. My partner already knew he was positive, and most of my friends were already positive and either getting sick or knew they were positive, and so I didn't need to find out, because I just thought, you know, like, what is that going to do to my ambition, you know, if I find out that I've got a death sentence, you know, to look forward to. So I put it off and I put it off, but then Ron passed away, and I lost Gordon, my best friend, and my partner Ron in 93. They both died the same year. And after that, I had to know. So I went and finally got tested, and sure enough, I was positive, which I pretty much already knew. And then I got quite involved once I took my long-term disability, because at that time, when you've tested positive, your doctor just told you have to take your disability, because every day you continue to work causes you stress, which will kill you that much faster. So you need to take your long-term disability and get your affairs in order. You have 5 years. I remember being told that point blank by my doctor, and just thinking, well, just leaving the doctor's office that day, kind of feeling a bit numb. But that was just the way it was, and pretty much, you know, it once I found out I was positive, I was able to maintain my health for longer than most of my friends and my partner. I think it's because I was in school a lot of the time, so I wasn't out partying with everybody else. I was home studying, So I didn't get sick myself until I started to get sick in the fall of, or in the summer of 96. And then by Halloween, I was admitted to St. Paul's Halloween night, 1996, with severe PCP pneumonia. I'd already been home with just horrible night sweats and nausea and fever for a few weeks at that point, by the time I was admitted to St. Paul's. And I remember being admitted to St. Paul's, and I remember quite clearly it was Halloween night, 1996. And then Sequinivir, the very first of the new protease inhibitors, was being given on compassionate access, was available at the very beginning of November. And my doctor I was one of the first patients that was granted access to Sequinivir in 96. And what can I say? It saved my life. It turned everything around, and who would have ever guessed it was going to turn things around as much as it did? Because here I am, you know, like, what, 23 years later? And it's crazy, but I've never been as healthy as I am now. And I've gone on to beat colon cancer, which was, again, related to the HIV meds interacting with another virus that caused my colon cancer, or my anal cancer. But I survived that too. I beat cancer, survived that. And then most recently I've had a heart transplant in 2013. but in the big picture, now I run 5 days a week, I've got a dog, I work part-time. it's not so bad, you know, but who'd have ever guessed? Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. So, I remember the heart surgeon talking to me about it, saying, well, you've got somebody up there watching after, or looking over you. He said, so you must be here for some reason. And I said, well, I just wish I could figure out what that reason is, but maybe it's so I can tell this story. I don't know. Hmm. But anyhow, here I am.
Wow. With Sequinivir, was it like this really dramatic, instantaneous?
It was unbelievable, actually. Like, I was so sick, and I remember when I was first admitted to St. Paul's, they were only giving me, I think, 70-30 chance of dying. Like, I had a 30% chance of living. And then I started the Sequinivir, and God, within about 6 weeks, it just turned everything around. I started gaining weight again. Like, I was down to 101 pounds, I think. That's what it was, either 101 or 103. I'd lost a lot of weight. And it was definitely wasting disease, because that was one of the biggest, big killers back then, right up there with KS and PCP and thrush. And cytomegalovirus, the one that caused you to go blind. God, it was a terrifying time. It really was a scary time back then. But here I am, you know, like, who'd have ever guessed? But, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say.
I can poke around a little more.
Yeah, sure.
But just let me know if I'm going anywhere you don't want to go.
Sure.
So information back then, what was there out there, you know, thinking back to the mid-80s when you were first hearing about
HIV? Not a lot. That's back when they were calling it GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. yeah, there wasn't a lot of information. They had no idea how, they suspected it was being sexually transmitted, but they had no real positive proof, at least not that I recall. Possibly I'm wrong. But I think once they had actually isolated HIV, which I think was in 86, then they knew definitively that it was being sexually transmitted. And then the big push for for the safe sex. But I remember at one point, having this attitude that I was HIV positive and I was going to die with everybody else anyhow. What does it matter if I have safe sex? And I don't really remember being unsafe, like when I was out and about, but I wasn't out and about a whole lot. Again, I was, I had a committed partner, and up until 93 at least. And after 93, between 93 and 96, I don't remember a whole lot of promiscuity, just because I was grieving so much and I was starting to get sick myself. So, which usually doesn't lend to having a, really active libido.
No.
But there wasn't a lot of information out there. The only information I recall offhand was to make sure you have safe sex. And that's about all I can recall right offhand. Ask me some more questions.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so there was kind of an emerging consensus around using condoms.
Yeah. Yeah. But everybody hated using them because they, they didn't promote an erection or. Yeah. It was just, it was 30 years ago too. The condoms 30 years ago were different from the condoms these days.
Sure.
But,
And gay men weren't used to using condoms.
Not at all. No. No, not at all. In fact, I remember going to the bathhouses, and the bathhouses used to sell little Dixie cups full of Crisco for 50 cents a Dixie cup. And everybody knows that Crisco and condoms don't go well together. But, that was just the way it was. It was just a different time. So people were trying to get their head around, practicing safe sex. But it's like you said, like prior to AIDS and HIV, gay men just weren't used to ever even thinking about condoms. But when we started seeing how sick people were starting to get, it gave more and more people incentive to be safe. Mm-hmm. And I remember friends of mine from San Francisco being so terrified of serial converting that they would douse themselves in bleach, like after having sex with somebody, even though it was safe sex. But they would still go into the bathroom and pour a bottle of bleach over themselves, because that's how scary it was. Like, that's how scary it was. Yeah. Like, people, like, young men in their prime dying, you know? And not just dying, but dying quickly. Like, from the time they first started feeling that first bit of sickness, like nausea, to the point where they were dead, sometimes was, you know, a few weeks. Other times it dragged on for a few years. But it was, we called it the roller coaster. It was just a series of ups and downs, and then you would finally finish the ride. But
I mean, really, really horrifying.
It was
graphic death.
Yeah, it was awful. It was awful. It was like, I remember my good friend Gordon. When he died, he was 31, and it looked like he was turning 91. You know, I remember going to see him in St. Paul's the last day he was alive. I'm thinking, oh my God, he looks like he's 91, and he just turned 31, you know? And, yeah, it was pretty gruesome, you know? And here was a guy who had been, like, 180 pounds and like, with a solid build, and he was probably down to about 105 pounds, 110 pounds by the time he died. There was nothing left. It was just a skeleton. And I'm not kidding, he looked like a 90-year-old little old man laying in that hospital bed. I still remember that quite vividly. And and Ron too, my partner, like, when by the time he passed, he was like 180 pounds and solid, and I think he was about 110, 112 pounds when he passed away. He was just a skeleton again. But that was how everybody was dying. You know, so it would start with PCP, usually one or two bouts of PCP, and then the KS and thrush and the wasting, and it was usually just a matter of time. And I thought I was well on my way out as well, and then came Sequinivir, you know, in the fall of '96, And here I am 23 years later, you know? Yeah. I don't know what else to say.
What did support look like back then for somebody who was HIV positive?
Well, within my own community, within the gay community, we were great. Like, it's like I said, we built BCPWA in no time. That organization was up and running. And we basically were looking after ourselves, you know, because, like I said, nobody else was helping us, and nobody else even wanted to, for the most part, even touch us. It was awful. It was awful for about 10 years there. It was really nasty. And I remember even my family, like, I thought, oh my God, like, it was tough enough me being gay, but when I was diagnosed with AIDS. And then, and how they found out was, one of my good friends I'd gone to university with, when I was admitted to St. Paul's with the really bad pneumonia, the PCP, in the fall of '96, he actually thought he was doing me a favor by contacting my family. Like, you know, like most people would just think that that's a no-brainer. You've got to call his family and let them know how sick he is. But they had no idea. And that's how they found out. And all I remember is waking up in St. Paul's one morning, so sick, and there were my parents standing there. And I thought, what the fuck? What are you doing here? But at least to say, that's how they found out. And they were pretty great, actually, the way that they handled it. So, and I actually ended up going back to Alberta after I'd been discharged from St. Paul's. I think I was home for about 3 months, and I just convalesced in my parents' home. And that's where like the weight started to come back, and, mm-hmm. and I remember my parents even commenting on the remarkable how well I was getting. Everybody was like, because nobody would have ever imagined that the triple combination therapy was going to be as effective as it was, but it was. And next thing we knew, like, all these people that were on their deathbeds, myself included, were suddenly rebounding. And here I am, 23 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But on the other hand, like, to have the drugs that saved my life interact with another completely unrelated virus and cause my anal cancer in 2001, and of all the health issues I've been through, that was probably by far the worst, was the cancer, because the radiation and the chemotherapy, and I spent 2 years at the cancer clinic, and the process basically neutered me, and I haven't had much of a sex life since then. But, you know, life goes on. You find other things, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, even those early, like, effective drugs had some pretty nasty side effects, I know.
Yeah, very nasty. Yeah, the neuropathy and also just, who would have ever guessed that there was going to be an interaction between the AIDS drugs and HPV that would go on to cause cancer. And yeah, that kind of sucked, but you know, but on the other hand, I've beat cancer now too, you know. And so I'm a survivor, that's for sure.
No kidding.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't really quite understand why, but I'm a survivor. And I'm, you know, very grateful to still be here to tell this story.
Mm-hmm. Where does that resilience come from?
I really don't know, to be quite honest. I often wonder that myself. Because I don't get it from my parents, because my father is still an alcoholic. My mother died of alcoholism when I was 14. My stepmother is still an alcoholic. And I've never been an alcoholic. I think that's just because, I don't know. I don't know where it comes from. I really don't know. Mm. I just know I'm a survivor, you know? So maybe it's because I feel as though there's social functions that there's no damn way I'm going to miss out on. And so I'm sticking it out just so I don't miss those parties. And there's a lot of wonderful stuff in life too, you know, like my dogs and my friends, and it can be very frustrating at times too, you know, like it kind of sucked, you know, being told to take my disability in 93, because at that time I had quite a career looking ahead of me. You know, I had just finished doing an honors degree in molecular biology at UBC in 1990, and then to be told in 93 that you have to stop working and take your long-term disability. And I never have been able to, you know, have any kind of career since then. I've gone back to work part-time in the last 4 years since the heart surgery. But it's, you know, it's been, you know, pretty simple jobs, like, you know, working at the grocery store. And I worked at the art gallery for a little while until I found out that standing on concrete for hours upon end was just not good for my body. But you know, it's just the fact that I'm here, being able to go back to work part time in itself is pretty remarkable. So I don't know, but I do. I think I still grieve my career, you know, because you know, at one time I thought I was going to have quite a career ahead of me, and it's turned out that I'm, you know, live quite a meager, at least financially. I live, you know, I'm a poor person. And I think that's probably the one of the toughest parts I still find. I still find that, like, at times I think, geez, I wonder if I really made the right decision taking my long-term disability back in 93. But at that time, you know, it was a different time. And if your doctor told you that you needed to do this because basically that's the way it worked, was that if you kept working, you'd die even faster. And so we were all taking our long-term disability, and then I think a lot of us were doing our best to basically party ourselves into the grave, because we were just going to die anyhow. And yeah, it was a different time. So
I know part of what we're wanting to do with this project as well is to look at what the needs of long-term survivors are in the present. So it's important for us to know, like, I mean, a lot of folks are still on long-term disability from this time.
Yeah. Yeah, myself included.
That's a tough existence.
Yeah, who would, and then, what was it, 3 years ago? Canada Pension Plan disability, long-term, they actually cut me off. And, because they said that if you can work part-time, you can go back to work full-time. I said, I've been on long-term disability for 23 years, and you're telling me that you're the one who encouraged me to go back to work part-time, and now that I have, you're telling me that you're cutting me off and that I have to go back to work full-time? Well, thank God for provincial policies, because all that happened was I had to go to the province. But thank God that they, you know, said, no, we're not expecting somebody who's been on long-term disability for 23 years to go back to work full-time. We'll just top you up by the same amount that CPP has cut you off. And but I couldn't believe that they actually cut me off after 23 years, you know. But that's how much HIV has changed these days, you know. So in some ways it's wonderful. But when it comes to a long-term survivor's sense, It's frustrating, yeah. Yeah, to like have my income taken away because they're saying, okay, well, you can go back to work full time now. Well, no, I can't. Yeah, like part time, I can. Like, I'll agree, part time, I'm capable of that. But I find that part time even is taxing enough. And so I can't imagine going back full time, but anyhow.
The meds you're on today, how do you have side effects with those at all?
Well, again, I'm one of the very, very, very fortunate few in that I'm on the same combination, triple combination regimen that I've been on, I think, for about 12 years now. And my doctor's attitude is that as long as you're not experiencing any side effects, and as long as you haven't developed any resistance, that if it ain't broke, you don't fix it. And because I was talking to her at one point about trying out one of these one pill a day type regimens, but as she, you know, made me realize that it's just three pills that have been combined into one. But her attitude was again that, you know, don't play around with something that's not broke. So, because this way we've got all kinds of options down the pipeline if we should ever need them. But I'm Carol Murphy, or maybe I shouldn't have used the full name. But my doctor at the time, she said, you account for about 2% of my HIV patients in that the fact that you're just doing phenomenal on the regimen you're on. So, in other words, let's just stay the course as long as you don't mind. I said, no, I don't really. I just, you know, thought it might be more convenient to just only have to have one pill a day, but I guess three pills a day, it's not that big a deal. You know, I find that being compliant and I miss very few doses because, you know, it's just, you know, morning pills. I've gotten used to it. So, yeah. I don't know what else to say.
I might have a couple other quick questions.
Sure.
Do you remember anything about how the government was responding back in the 80s and 90s?
They were awful. They weren't even acknowledging the fact that, I remember in the States, Reagan wouldn't even acknowledge the fact that we were dying in droves, you know? And I don't really recall offhand whether it was just as bad here, but I don't remember it being all that much better. I just remember that in the 80s there was just so much stigma attached. Like once they had identified HIV and they could actually diagnose you as being HIV positive, there was just so much fear. And I remember people being afraid to drink out of a glass that we had drank out of, even though it'd been through a dishwasher, you know. But that's how much stigma there was revolving around each. And I guess rightfully so, because if you saw the way that people were dying back then, it was terrible. It was terrifying. Yeah, it was terrifying. Yeah. But
I imagine a lot of those fears and the stigma stuck around for a lot longer, even after
We're still dealing with,
you know, to the contrary.
We're still dealing with a lot of stigma surrounding HIV. But these days, the stigma has almost evolved somewhat. Like these days, if like you go into a community health clinic or just a walk-in clinic and you identify yourself as being HIV positive, they just jump to the conclusion that at one point you've used IV drugs. And it's like, you know, there's still some of us around that got it the old-fashioned way. You know, from having unprotected sex back when we didn't know any better. But and that's the way that the stigma has evolved. Like it's gone from, you know, everybody just, you know, basically knowing that the way it was transmitted was you were having unprotected anal sex. Whereas it's true these days, it's like I've had to correct medical professionals and just say, look, no, I have never been an IV drug user. Like, I got it, you know, back in the old days. And it's interesting how, but there's still a lot of stigma revolving around HIV, even these days. Yeah, it's just, it's evolved, just like the treatment has.
It's interesting because, I mean, obviously initially it was like the gay disease.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was the gay plague. Yeah.
And now it's not.
No, not by any means. It's evolved. In fact, Tom McCall, or I shouldn't use full names, a friend of mine who's chairman at BC, or at Positive Living these days, he told me, he was trying to convince me to come back down and do some more volunteer work with Positive Living about 6 months ago. And he was saying that, he goes, you are right though in the assumption that, he goes, 90% of people accessing services down at Positive Living these days are IV drug addicts. You know, it's just the gay guys, we just run the place. So it's evolved in that sense, you know, and it's true. I don't have much to do with those organizations anymore, just because the crowd that for the most part is in there is quite a rough crowd, and it's just it's not who I am. It's not who I've ever been, and I find that they can be a lot of work to have to deal with, a lot of angry people, a lot of. And I can understand where it's coming from, but on the other hand, I don't necessarily want to have to deal with it myself. You know, that's not who I am or ever have been. You know, so it's evolved.
What did your involvement look like at those organizations when you were involved?
Oh, I volunteered with treatment information with Positive Living from the time I took my long-term disability, which was 93, mm-hmm. Right up until I think pretty much 2001, 2002, I volunteered with treatment information and was very involved with them. And but then I kind of got burned out on HIV and took a break. And well, 2001, that's right, that's when I left BCPWA, because 2001 was when I was diagnosed with cancer. And I had to just remove myself because I was dealing with cancer. And since I've beat cancer, I've just kind of, you know, concentrated on health and my dogs and now the heart surgery. You know, but the heart surgery is what really changed things dramatically. And now I've gone back to work part time, and I run 5 days a week, and it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you're in a good place now in a lot of ways.
getting into a better place. Still working on it. Yeah, still working on it. I think that times being on long-term disability can be... It's frustrating just because, you know, it's just... It's it's at times it's not really living, it's just existing. The working the part-time has been what's allowed me to live a little bit again, as opposed to just existing. And I think that's the problem with long-term disability, is it can be a bit of a trap. But who'd have ever guessed that we were going to be on long-term disability for as long as we have been?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, again, I was given, originally told, 5 years, get your affairs in order. And that's what I did. I got my affairs in order. And it was, you know, just about right on schedule. But then came Sequinivir and changed everything. Hmm. Yeah.
I know the treatment information component of PWA was quite innovative at the time and doing a lot of their own research.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it like to be involved in that?
Oh, it was really interesting, actually. In fact, I used to be involved with what was called the Treatment Information Project, the ABCs on the Roadshow. And we would travel all over the province, and we would talk to nurses and doctors and all these small-town clinics and hospitals. And we would, you know, talk on all the recent treatment updates. And it was actually very interesting and very, very rewarding. And I miss it sometimes, but again, by the time I was dealing with cancer, I just thought, okay, I need to take a break from HIV. I've been living HIV for, you know, like 20 years at that point, and I had to deal with my cancer, and so I let all that kind of go. And I'm just starting to, just this last year, I've done the PLDI training through the Pacific AIDS Network. I've done the core training, and I've done the communications training. And I've been thinking about going back to work in my community. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it's necessarily what I want to do anymore. Because just because HIV has evolved, it's a lot of drug addiction these days in HIV. And I think it takes a special person to work in that, to work with that community. And I don't think I'm one of those special people. I think I don't think I have the patience, to be quite honest.
I mean, it's also like so much of that work is kind of peer oriented.
Yeah.
And you're not a peer in that.
Not
that
any
part.
No, I'm
that
not.
Part, right?
No, I'm not. Exactly. Yeah, because it's never been, you know, it's never been who I was or who I am. I find that community can be can be very trying at times. Mm-hmm. You know, like I try to be compassionate, but at times it's trying.
Well, there are still a lot of young gay men getting HIV. So
oh, I know.
I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
Like in
terms
of organizationally.
Yeah. Well, that's. I think they're all going to Health Initiative for Gay Men these
probably
days.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But because positive living and the Dr. Peter Center is, until they started up this recent Wednesday night men's group at mm-hmm. the Dr. Peter Center, mm-hmm. it's just the drugs have just, you know, it's just there's a lot of drug usage going on. And it's just, again, it's not who I am. And it's just, and because of it, I've stopped going to a lot of these organizations over the last few years, just because it's not who I am, you know. And yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know how else to put it.
That Wednesday night group, though, sounds like it's
fantastic.
Long overdue.
It's fantastic. It is. It's been so long overdue, and it's wonderful. It's a small group still. It's, you know, it's not that many guys, but it's growing continuously, and because there's still a lot of us out there that have been living with this now for like 20 some years, you know, and we still have needs too, you know. We still like to have our little social groups and social groups where we're not having to deal with people who are, you know, high on drugs, and because at times it can be a bit trying. So anyhow, I think I've developed almost a bit of a prejudice towards drug addicts and IV drug users, just because I don't know, it's just I find them very high maintenance. And because of that, I've stopped going to these organizations that my community built, you know? And, but there's the Wednesday Night Men's Group that I mentioned. All of us there agree that that's what we love about this new Wednesday Night Men's Group, because all of us felt almost pushed out of these organizations that we built. But it's just the evolution of HIV, you know. You can't say, you know, you can't access services here because you have an IV drug habit. You can't do that. It's just, it's HIV these days, you know, so it's just the Wednesday Night Men's Group, the way that they've kind of gotten around that is by stipulating 50 or older. You have to be over 50 just to go to that group. And by doing that right away, you eliminate the drug addict portion for the most part. Like it's guys like myself, you know, that have been living with this virus for 30 years now. So, and it's kind of nice to have a group of guys that we meet at once a week, just, you know, as a support group and a social type thing. Yeah. And in fact, I've recently met the first guy that I've dated in 18 years. Wow. I've just met him at 6 months ago. We've been seeing each other now. It's been really nice, actually. Yeah, who'd have ever guessed that I was going to be falling in love again? And he's a wonderful man. He's a retired school teacher, and he's got a lovely condo right on the park. And
wow,
yeah, it's really nice. It's really nice. Yeah, and I'm falling so in love. It's really nice.
It's a wonderful feeling.
It is a wonderful feeling. Like, yeah. who'd have ever guessed that I was going to be falling in love at this point in my life, you know? I'd gotten so used to being, you know, single, and since the cancer, because it just changed things so dramatically. But, you know, this guy, he's not expecting miracles, you know, and he's patient and he's kind and he's sweet. He loves my dog. And yeah, it's kind of cool.
Very cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm going over there for dinner after I finish here.
That's a good thing to do after a conversation like this.
Yeah.
For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew this was probably going to be a bit heavy. So,
yes.
But I felt as though, you know, like, come on, Richard, you lived through this horrible time, and I think I've got something to share here. Yeah. So.
Well, thank you for sharing it with me.
Yeah, sure.
I'm most of the way I only have a few questions kind of left. Just some kind of broader questions around, for example, how has your perspective on HIV changed looking toward the present?
Oh God, HIV is the least of my concerns.
Yeah.
It really is. Like, at one point it was just, it was the most terrifying thing in the world. And now it's the least of my concerns. Like, I know that HIV is not going to be what gets me. It's going to be just one of the diseases of aging. like my heart issue, like it was congenital. Mm. I'd known about it since I was 4. That one day I was going to have, you know, serious heart surgery. But nobody ever thought I was going to live that long to begin with. But here I have. And now, and this is how much HIV has changed. Because 15 years ago, they would never have given me the organ. Because they would have said, there's no way we are giving a perfectly good, healthy organ to an AIDS patient. Whereas these days, since 2013, I'm not kidding, I got all human parts. And it's because when it came to my other cardiac risk factors, I remember the surgeon telling me, he said, you couldn't present a better profile. He goes, you don't smoke, you don't drink, your cholesterol is perfect, your blood pressure is perfect, your weight is perfect, you don't live a sedentary life, you're active, you exercise. Consequently, that's why this is all happening so fast, and consequently, you're getting all human parts. So, there you go. That's how much HIV has evolved in the last 15 years in particular, because I'm not kidding, 15 years ago, there's no way I would have ever gotten the heart. They would have said, no way. We're not giving a perfectly good organ to an AIDS patient. Whereas today, it's changed that much. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, actually, when you think about it. But, and here I am, you know. Now I've got a new heart and a life to enjoy it with, you know? Yeah. And now I've met a new guy, and it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Again, thinking on like a larger scale, how do you think HIV changed the gay community here in Vancouver?
It brought us together as a community. In fact, I haven't seen our community come together that well, or in that. It was just amazing. It was because it's true. Nobody else even wanted to touch us, and that's when, I'm not kidding, all my gay sisters, even. That's when the lesbian community, like, oh my God, they were amazing. They were just amazing. You know how we all came together, and built these organizations, and helped each other out, and started the buddy program, we did it ourselves, and yeah, it's one of the things that makes me very proud to be a gay man, is how we handled the beginnings of that epidemic, because it's true, we did it, and because nobody else even wanted to have anything to do with us, you know, they were also terrified of us. And I guess rightfully so. It was that terrifying. It really was. It was just like to see somebody in the prime of their life to be, you know, whittled away to a skeleton within, you know, within weeks or months or at most a couple years, you know. And these are, you know, guys in the prime of their lives, you know. Yeah. It's like Ron, my partner, he was 36. Yeah, Gordon was 31, you know, and yeah, it was a different time back then. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, that's what always stands out to me too, is the, like, from hearing so many of these stories, is just the immense loss on a community level, but also God. The immense strengthening of the community that happened simultaneously.
Oh, it did, yeah. Like, we were dying in droves, but we really came together as a community. Yeah, it's like that AIDS memorial down at the beach. I still find it hard to go by there, and because I just know so many names on that memorial, and I know too many names on that memorial, but I still, every year I try to go by and put a flower in Ron's name and in Gordon's name, and I still try to do that every year, but I still find it difficult. I still find it difficult to have to scan all those names to find where, you know, Ron is again and find where Gordon is. And I know, you know, basically the panel to look on now, but yeah, it's still tough to go down and see all those names on that memorial, because wow, do I ever know a lot of names on that memorial. But, and they've been gone for so many years now, you know. And time heals, it's true. That old adage. It gets easier. And then you start to remember just the good times as opposed to the awful times, you know. But there was a lot of awful times back then. It was nightmarish. It really was. I remember that was my biggest fear. I remember when I first realized that my family now knew is being totally shunned by my family, and except for my older brother, but he's always been a bit of a tight ass anyhow. But the rest of my family has been just amazingly supportive, you know, and continues to be, you know, to this day, you know, yeah. So I'm lucky in that sense, because mm-hmm. I know a lot of guys back then, their families did, you know, just shun them. And I remember partners of you know, who, guys who had lost their partner, and then the family showed up and told them to get out of the apartment, and that they were taking everything that belonged to him because it was theirs. Oh, it was awful. It was an awful time. It was an awful time. Yeah. And back then we had no legal recourse because we weren't, our relationships weren't even acknowledged. You know, like we were homos living in sin, you know, and it was just, yeah, it was a tough time. But
all the more reason to remember it in a lot of ways.
I think so. I think that's why I thought this was important to do, you know, so, yeah, because it was a dreadful time, but, you know, here we are.
Well, what advice do you have for younger folks out there in the community as a long-term survivor who's lived through this and seen HIV for what it was? Do you have any advice for younger folks who didn't live through this?
To not take it lightly. That even with the PrEP and the PEP that's out there these days, and that you do not want this virus because it's not a cakewalk, you know, like there's a lot of side effects and there are long-term consequences. And I look at what's going on right now with myself. Like I've just had this heart surgery, and about 6 months ago I had a diagnosis of atrial fibrillation, and so the doctors wanted to put me on warfarin, which is a blood thinner, but because my bowel was so irradiated to beat cancer, which was caused by the HIV meds interacting with another virus, but I was bleeding so badly from my rectum that they had to stop the blood thinners to stop me from having a stroke. And so there are complications further down the road that sometimes you could never see coming. And that's what's like right now, my doctor, my new doctor, how he put it, he said, well, we're going to have to do a very careful dance around this because you are dealing with such a badly irradiated bowel. And in order to get you on the blood thinners, to get your INR up to a level that we know that there's no risk of stroke, but unfortunately, in order to get there, you're bleeding so bad out of your rectum that we're risking you becoming anemic. So we have to stop the blood thinners so that you don't bleed so badly. And it all adds up. And it started with HIV, you know? And it's just, you know, don't take it lightly. It's not worth taking those kind of risks, you know? So if there's one message I could possibly try to get pass on to the young gay guys these days, is don't take it lightly to practice safe sex. It's not worth the risk.
What about for folks who might be newly diagnosed?
To make sure you're compliant on your meds and keep that viral load undetectable. And as long as you do, and as long as you're willing to do your own part when it comes to your health, in other words, you know, stay away from drugs and actually work at your health, then HIV these days is not that big a deal. Like as long as you're willing to do your own part when it comes to your health, and you're compliant with your medications, for the most part, you're fine. Like I've been undetectable now for almost 20 years. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Yeah, when you think about it, you know, like yeah, because I remember when I was first the first viral load I ever had done. It was shortly after I'd been diagnosed with PCP pneumonia, and I think it was well over 300,000, like 300,000 or 400,000, which was scary. But that was, you know, that was when I wasn't on any kind of medication. That was when there was no medication. That was when the only medication available was AZT as a monotherapy, which was a total failure. Yeah, just, you know, as long as you've got to be willing to do your part when it comes to your health, too, So in other words, you need to eat properly, sleep properly, and look after yourself, you know, love yourself. So I think sometimes young gay guys have a tough time doing that, you know, including as I did when I was younger, you know. Again, there's still a lot of stigma. Just, you know, I think the whole just being gay issue is a lot easier these days than it was back in the 60s and 70s when I was a little gay kid. But when it comes to dealing with HIV, yeah, you need to do your own part when it comes to your health, because that's what I've noticed is the people these days that are still getting sick from HIV, for the most part, it's people who are, you know, using IV drugs and out partying way too much and not looking after themselves well enough. And but that's not terribly surprising, you know, like if that's the kind of stuff you're doing, you know, it's not terribly surprising that there's going to be complications arise out of the fact that you're HIV positive. But I don't know what else to say.
I mean, that's kind of it for my formal questions. We do always like to leave some space at the end just to let you add anything that we maybe haven't touched on or that you wanted to expand upon before we turn off the recorder.
No, not really. No, I think I'm good.
Great. And then I'll just thank you again for sharing your story with me.
My pleasure.
We'll stop this.
I hope it's something you find helpful.
I mean, I think for sure. I mean, I certainly find it helpful.
Okay.